On a given morning, do you really want to be talking about parking priorities rather than reading a really first-rate new book that came out in cultural history? So the ambivalence on my part is I actually do get some immediate sense of satisfaction in working with a team of people. I think this university has been, by and large, administered by talented, impressive people. And I don't mind being part of that team. I enjoyed either being on high committees or when I was director of the research center, you essentially kind of sit with people in various ways that are involved in the running of the university. And I find that interesting. I've always had a fascination with it. And I just managed to do it on the cheap, in a way. I never could make the plunge that would say it would bring me out of the scholarly role that I was trained to do. I've been ambivalent about it. Some people have said, well, gee, are you going to miss it? I've been approached for a lot of deanship searches at other universities. This is not to say I would have necessarily been good at it. I've not been tried in this thing. The research center 2 years was kind of a, as I say, almost a free ride. The place is so well staffed. I made some minor contributions over there, but I don't think anyone can say that I would have been a good dean. But people like the way I run committees, for whatever reasons, and I have this fascination with being around the people who run universities. And so I've given off these signals from time to time, and so people have talked to me about would I be a candidate for the deanship of the education school here or elsewhere? And I have consistently said no, and I think I've crossed the Rubicon on that one now. I think it'd be counterproductive. At age 55, I committed myself to going down to the University of Chicago because of my domestic partner, and what I want to do there is create a program in the history of American education. It's not likely that they would turn to me for an administrative role other than department chair, which gets passed around there like every place. So I think that's what's in the cards for me. I have a really busy research agenda, and I think I want to remake my world of students down there.
Well, we're going to end this conversation. When we do end this conversation, I am going to ask you about your plans at the University of Chicago. The thing that Palmer said is about you is he said you had that ability to look at both sides of an issue, of a very polarized issue, and to summarize each opposing camp's point of view and not make it sound silly or ludicrous or something that couldn't be worked out with a little bit of effort, and that you could help people find common ground in areas where they didn't think common ground may have existed. Mm-hmm. And he thought that was a very a rare and special talent for an administrator to have.
Well, people remarked things like that about me. That is pretty close to the one thing that people say, that that's why they think I might make a good administrator, this balancing and being able to... judicious is the nicest
judicious
word for it. Somebody recently called me judicious after a meeting. I thought, that's nice. That's wonderful. So at my best, I guess, I come off as judicious in a meeting. Whatever brains I have, they seem to be better applied to this business of trying to wend my way through the middle and get some other people to go with me than in being kind of radically creative on the edges.
Right.
Well, the worst thing about being radical and out on the side, on the edges, is if you're an ideologue, and the best thing is, if you're really creative, you might think up something really new. So I think if I was an administrator, I'd be the administrator I admire most that I would probably turn out being more like would be more like John Palmer, who's a great administrator when you have a place that's already doing pretty well. You know, it doesn't need radical restructuring. I don't know how I would do it, radical restructuring. I mean, who knows? I talked to Shalala about it once.
You tried that in Poland.
Yeah, we did.
What did you talk to Shalala? How did that?
Well, I said as an administrator, I thought that I would be more like John than somebody who would kind of really shake a place up and turn it in. You know, I don't think I'm venturesome enough to do the risk that would be involved. And also, when you shake a place up, some of the people you shake are really unhappy about it. And I don't have a thick enough skin for that. Now, I admire what John has done for the school, but to some degree, it's a little bit thankless. I mean, John Palmer has a real service notion of what a dean should do. It is to facilitate others' work. He doesn't have an egocentric notion of what it is like. Part of that is his persona and his upbringing and so forth. It's a modest, quiet persona. But part of it is also what he thinks administration is all about. And I guess I just never quite wanted to trade in scholarship for that.
Yeah.
You know, I love administrators who will do it, and I think there are a lot of others like John around the university who have done it.
Well, he was
Bernie Cohen,
a good and, scholar himself.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And so when you do your interview with him, have you interviewed him yet on his...
I'm going to be interviewing him on his last 5 years. He's been interviewed up to about 1985 by my predecessor. But
well,
I'm,
you'd want to ask him about that same trade-off, because when he came here, he was, you know, he was a philosopher of history, and he's given up a lot of intellectual life in order to do administration. And I don't mean to pigeonhole him as not creative. I think he's been very creative, but it's usually more like me, in the middle.
Yeah.
It's kind of creative middle management in order to facilitate the greatest good for the greatest number. It's usually not shutting half the place down, and, yeah. and you know, or trying some totally new way of thinking about the whole enterprise. And that's not what we've needed here. It's not what we've needed in the School of Education. It's by and large not what we've needed at the university as a whole. Although I would say Shalala's administrative style is shake it up and change it. And for my values, she did it on the right issues about undergraduate education and minority issues. But it shook some people up.
It sure did. I'd like to talk for a few moments, not long again, because we do have to move along here. I told you we're going to do 2 hours and that'll be it. You played an active role as a university citizen on this campus, taking over the directorship of the WCER for 2 years is, I think, one example of that. You were also on several important key committees here on campus. One of them being the Campus Planning Committee. Could you talk just a little bit about how long you were on that and some of the some of what you learned and maybe some of what the committee accomplished during that time as well?
Yeah, I think that may have been my first big university committee, and some of the members are elected and some are appointed, some from divisions, some deans are on there automatically. There are a lot of major university committees that have this variegated membership. Some are appointments at the chancellor's behest, some are appointed by the divisional committees. And I think I wasn't elected, but I think I was appointed by the divisional committee, which is sort of a representational thing. I can't remember. I don't think I ever ran for that. So suddenly I was on this campus planning committee, which for those of your listeners, those of our listeners who don't know, is not planning academic programs, it's planning the physical environment of the university from major building projects all the way down to bike paths and environmental issues.
A very important
and
committee
so
on
forth.
Campus. Yeah.
And it's a big one, and I think the term is 4 years. So, and I think it should be, because the building program of the state goes in biennia. Is that the plural? Yeah, it's biennial. So I think you serve two bienniums. One of the two in my years was the whole capital program was canceled, so that's another reason you'd want 4 years on there, because sometimes the state doesn't let you build anything. It's a wonderful university, it seems to me, to have a big professional architecture and planning division with professionals in it who have trained in that field. And then when you get to the questions of, but who should build their building first? The high energy physicists or the forestry department? Who's to make that decision? It's a value decision. It's based on the urgency and persuasiveness of academic programs. So who do they get at University of Wisconsin to do that? A bunch of deans and faculty, mostly faculty. So you think, well, I'm not competent to judge that, but you become the best shot at it we have.
Faculty,
you know?
Governance. It's
so you have the resources of these professional staffs with you, and there's a lot of briefings by architecture people and planning people and construction people and all that kind of stuff. But the decision makers in the end are this group of people sitting around the table. And you go in teams to investigate these various different proposals for the major building projects. So you get sent out in a team to get a slideshow by the nuclear physicists about how badly they need their new building or whatever it is, and so forth. I found it a fascinating experience. It's not quite as demanding as I later found the research committee at the graduate school, because there's somewhat less homework. There's a lot of plans to read and reports to read, but it met, I think, monthly, whereas the research committee of the graduate school, which is everybody I know who's been on it, said it was the busiest thing they were ever on, and unless they got to the university committee, which I never got to. Anyway, campus planning was fun. It was challenging. It gives you a real love for this place, because you get to know a little bit more more about the physical setting of
the
a lot of departments
setting,
that places you would never go in otherwise. And you learn a little bit about what the people do in the forestry school and whatever else. I must be mentioning these because I remember my visits to these places. I must have been assigned to them. I also got to know a little bit about, since that was my first big university committee, about how those kinds of committees work. The committee was chaired formally by the chancellor, but the chancellor traditionally did not run those meetings and came seldom. It was run by the then vice chancellor for administrative affairs, Len Van Ness, mm-hmm. who I liked a lot. I thought he did a good job, and was level-headed and pleasant and well-informed and so forth. But there were a lot of deans on there. David Cronin was on there the whole time I was on, and Waltz, the famous guy from the agriculture school, was on.
Leo
Waltz, and so forth. So it was a way to see experienced faculty members. I was maybe the youngest person on at that point, and deans making these kinds of decisions together. I didn't have a huge amount at stake in these things, so I wasn't passionate about any of these issues. One issue that I remembered, as close as I got to passionate on that one, this is one of the things I really agreed with Dave Cronin on, he and I bonded on this issue, was to try to keep Bascom Hill sacred the way it was. And the logic of that was twofold. One, there was an influential report called the Bascom Hill Report, and I wish I could remember the guy's name who did it. He was out of landscape architecture, logically enough. Was not a member of our committee, but he'd been asked to do this report. And he's since gone on to teach out east someplace. Long time ago he left. Anyway, the Bascom Hill Report pointed out to us that Bascom Hill is not some kind of a regularly shaped hill. It's not just a straight line that happens to go up topographically. It's very undulating and uneven. And that every rectangular space you carve out of it or plop on top of it interrupts the beauty of that undulating space. So this is a very poetic report. Mm-hmm. And it was very nice. And the issue at the time was whether the law school would be able to build a big addition out their back side. Mm-hmm. I say this now, of course, the university, they're doing that. They were prevented, I think is the right word to use, from doing that during the time I was on the planning committee. I said there were two reasons. One was this thing about the hill being so beautiful and undulating and irregularly shaped. The other is we could figure out that there will always be someone who says we have a critical, urgent need to build something on Bascom Hill. We figured if that's enough reason to do it, it will become a parking lot. I mean, it will become nothing but buildings. So where do you draw the line? And some of us on the campus planning committee just decided a good line would be right where it is right now. And unfortunately for the law school people who were very unhappy about this, we held the line. And at that point, there was a move to say, if you're too big, if your operations are too big for being on Bascom, there's only one solution now. The Bascom Hill Report is going to be the Bible around here forever, just the way no one would think of building on the grass tennis courts and lawn space on the west side of the university. There's a lot of green space out there, but it's sacred. So we wanted to make Bascom Hill sacred. And the business school was able to do, because of their resources, what we were recommending, which is, if you're too big for Bascom Hill, get off Bascom Hill.
Move somewhere else.
Now, the law school does not have the resources of Bascom, and I'm sure that many, many debates have been held in the quite some years since I've been on the campus planning committee about the law school's needs. But I also think that that was a lasting legacy, because it was a long time mm-hmm. before anything was built on Bascom mm-hmm. Hill, and I'm sure that environmental factors figured into the present design. Now, it will intrude somewhat outside of their space, but the general rule has been you can remodel if you want to. You just can't occupy new green space.
Well, I noticed, and I was surprised. I've been interviewing Ted Finman for the last month or two, a law professor, and every time I go up there, there's more of that building demolished. They did a lot of demolishing of the original building.
Yeah, they really gutted everything that was in between. There's a faculty tower, and then there's the library, and they're gutting everything in between, including their own old courtyard, which was quite lovely, and they're going to build up in the middle there. So I don't know that the perimeter would be a whole lot more.
Is that your fault that they had to do it that way?
I don't know. I don't know the debates about this. But I do remember I gave two speeches that some people giggled at and some people raised eyebrows at, I think. One was the people arguing in favor of the law school building an addition to their library out the back of the building, which would have been in that little space that has some diagonal walks on it that run from South Hall down toward... one of those dorms, women's dorms that are
Chadburn.
Chadburn and so forth. That little grassy space there, which is exactly what it is a prime example of what the Bascom Hill report said. They're undulating and they're irregular, and they wanted to build a rectangular addition out there. It wasn't that big, but it was gonna eat up a big bunch of that space. And I pointed out when I was an assistant professor walking over to the Ed School, I once saw a pheasant in there. People said, did he mean that? It was really true. But, you know, I was just saying, you know, it's a beautiful place. And they were arguing, oh, nobody ever uses that. Nobody cares about that. It's the backyard. So well, it's not the backyard to me.
The students, when they lived in the dorms in North Hall, they used to shoot pheasant out of their window. Of course, that was 125 years ago. But
the other speech I made, and it was a useless speech because it was after the fact. There was a plan. It ultimately failed because of lack of funding, I think. But there was a plan to build up a huge, to fill in the courtyard that's in the middle of the humanities building, which is an ugly space anyway because they never landscaped it or did anything with it. But they were going to bring it up to the parapet level, which is on the third floor level. And it was going to stick up so you couldn't see through it. It was going to be opaque. And so they were going to not only fill in that space, but they were going to block the entire angle of vision. And I had been on leave for one of my 4 years on the committee, and I came back, and there was this thing. It was all done. It was all approved and everything. And I remember Judy Craig, who was Dave Cronin's assistant, kind of laughing at my saying, I'm sorry I've been away for a year. I don't agree with this. I said, I'm one of the few people that actually think there's some redeeming features of the humanities building. And most people just think the whole thing is a loss. But I think that the one redeeming feature is the view of Bascom from that parapet or over toward Vilas Communication Hall from that parapet. And you're going to have this big kind of bubble sticking up as if somebody's blowing a bubble from down on. And luckily for me, that never happened, but it was only because I think the money never came around. It was going to be badly needed space for art and music, and I think there was going to be some kind of a gallery in there. So that was the Campus Planning Committee. I'm sorry to go along
that. Let's move on. You mentioned that the most work you ever did on a committee was on the research committee of the graduate school. Talk about that committee for a few minutes.
Well, you'll get a lot of respondents to talk about that, so maybe I can be a little shorter than my war stories about the campus planning committee. I knew a bit about what they did because I had applied for grants from them, and I'd known some people that had served on it. People said it's a great seminar, and it's a killer in terms of the time. It's a three-year stint, and it meets every... Once it starts about 3 or 4 weeks, I guess, after the fall semester begins, and it meets only in the fall, except for a few honorary things that they decide on in the spring, one-shot meetings. But when it's doing the major sorting out of grants within the university, the money from the Wisconsin Alumni Research Fund Foundation, matching grants to faculty, carrot and stick grants to faculty, you know, like backup grants if they don't get their grant and all that kind of stuff. When they're sorting those out, it met every Wednesday afternoon and Saturday morning for the rest of the semester.
Saturday morning?
It met 4 hours Wednesday afternoon and 4 hours Saturday morning. We would quit early on home football games, which didn't really faze me because I didn't go to home football games. I was a hockey guy. But yeah, we had donuts. That was our reward. Too many donuts and coffee and 8 hours of meetings a week. But in addition to that, you had to take one or two department submissions, read them, and interview each person in their offices and then present them. So you had to do the interviews, you had to then do some homework at home. A lot of people would type the whole thing out, report and so forth, and you had to succinctly summarize this proposal to the rest of the committee, and you had to go to these 8 hours of meetings a week. So I don't know what it wound up to be. That's probably a 15-hour-a-week job
at least,
on average. I mean, it was uneven because when you did your departments of interviews, you just stopped everything else in your life and just did nothing but go around and interview these people. It was wonderful intellectually. I did the geography department 1 year. Since nobody could figure out whether I was a humanist or a social scientist, they used to kind of plug me into different departments. And I did the music department 1 year because Ed Black, who assigned me to it, he was an associate dean for the humanities, said nobody else knew where middle C was on the committee. They just didn't have a musician, so I had a wonderful time doing that. I did a variety of departments. I did the law school one year, so you learn a huge amount. It's a wonderful committee, and it's a way to learn about your colleagues and about what goes on in different disciplines. You get to read pieces of your colleagues' work. So that was a lot of fun, and I think I copped out of my third year. I think I became the director of the research center. So I served 2 years on it, and then I got to be director, and I got this plaintive call from Ed Black. He said, "Would you just do the music department? We don't have a musician again." So they got used to me a second year around the music department, and we did pretty well. We got a lot of people grants, and you know that committee was like one year you're trying to remind yourself again what Kant and Hegel said about moral education or ethics or something, and the next year you're trying to figure out how to present a jazz project by Richard Davis. So it's real, real fun, and there's a real spirit of engagement on that committee.
An interesting way to find out what's going on in some of these departments.
It's a great committee. The parallel to that in my life right now is the Spencer Postdoctoral Fellowship Program of the National Academy of Education. It's the same thing. It's a huge load of work. You get shipped out these, 60 out of the 260 or so applicants, because each applicant gets 3 good reads or something on a committee of 9 or 10. And you get these 60 gigantic proposals, and you read them, and then you go to a meeting to cut the 260 down to 60, and then you go to another meeting and get outside opinions, and you go to another meeting out of town and try and cut them down to 30 postdoctoral fellows. There are a lot of activities like that in academia that if they get the right reputation and the right group of people, people say, you know, it's really worth it. And it's usually partly for who's directing it, who's in charge. David Ward was marvelously good. Ed Black was good, but David was extremely good. And the same with this fellowship committee I'm on. It's now run by Howard Gardner, a psychologist at Harvard.
Well, I was going to ask about that later on under national things, but let's talk about it. We're here. Let's get into it a little bit. It's called the National Academy of Education. How do you get on that committee, and what is its charge, essentially?
Well, let's talk about the National Academy of Education. National Academy of Education started around 1965, and the notion was to start an academy among scholars of education that would be, although a much smaller version, something like the National Academy of Sciences. It would be an invitational group of presumably excellent people who studied education from the different disciplines. And the founding fathers included people like Conant and John Gardner.
James Bryant Conant, we're talking.
Yeah, and Jerome Bruner, the psychologist, and so forth. Bernard Balin, my mentor. These are all among the early or founding members. It had 75 members. I was elected to it in 1980 in a division of historians and philosophers, which numbered 15. So it's not as if, you know, it's just the top of the
heat. Are you nominated for that?
Yeah, you're nominated from within. And the criticism of it would be twofold. One is that there are certain networks, you know, if your mentor is in it, you're more likely to get into it than if you went to New Mexico for your PhD. And that is, you know, that is true if you kind of plot the thing out, but we've made a lot of efforts to try and diversify and find the talented people who are outside the institutions of the major ones who are already in. So that would be one criticism. The other criticism is that it's a kind of elitist place that defines itself by who's not in it and doesn't do any good in the world. And in my cohort and generation, we've been trying to change that in a big way. We changed the constitution and the way people are elected. We abolished the sections so we could elect everybody at large, which meant we could move into new areas that hadn't been represented before, like sociolinguistics and law and education and ethnography. And we moved the membership from 75 to 125, with a lot more emphasis on taking some chances and taking some risks with younger people and people who are themselves more diverse, but also whose fields are more diverse. So we've been responsive to that, and I was elected president of it 3 years ago, 2 years ago, whatever. I've been president for a year and a half, and the program, I guess you would call it, the agenda that I inherited but also that I have helped shape is to now accomplish that moving from 75 to 125, which is no small task, I mean, because the nominations take quite a bit of work. They undergo a lot of scrutiny and so forth, so you got to really keep people moving and working at it, and to do more public outward-looking projects. The postdoctoral fellowship program, which is funded by the Spencer Foundation, is one of the best things we do, and it's been looked upon by members as one of the best things we do for a long time. And it brings new blood into the academy because the people who are chosen for the fellowships attend our meetings for a period of 2 or 3 years. That means we always have a group of younger people around.
Do you guys meet at the same place?
No, we move around the country.
Is there a physical structure that deals with this, like in Washington?
We just decided to have a permanent home, and we decided not to be in Washington because we thought we're an academic group. We belong at a university, although that could be debated whether we should have been in Washington or not, because now I'm doing a lot of work with Washington, and it's a little hard to deal with Washington a lot if you have no representation there. But I agreed with this command decision of 3-4 years ago, and so another job I got as president was to find the site. And we had very good proposals from Chicago and Stanford, and we had a long discussion about which one to do, and we chose Stanford, which is now the permanent home of the academy. I think the reason to pick Stanford was people thought it was the best school of education in the country, even though we say now...
Was Mike Smith still there at the time, Dean?
No, when we made this decision, it was the interim acting dean.
Following Mike Smith's career through, since we talked so much about it earlier, he's now once again in Washington, once again for the working for a governor from a small southern state who's president, and he is, what is exactly...
He's called the Undersecretary of Education.
Undersecretary of Education, under Richard Riley, who is the Secretary of Education. Go on, Kirk.
The National Academy of Education does this postdoctoral fellowship thing, and that's a big program, and that supports 35 postdoctoral years off a year. So there's quite a coterie of people who have had them in the course of their lives. And that is a grant of $1.5 million or so a year to do it with, and that's what supports this. All we do is administer the fellowships, and the staff eats up some of that money because it's a very elaborate process of paperwork and so forth. And the selection committee gets together twice for two days and works on this stuff. The academy is located permanently at Stanford, has a staff of about 4, and then some more staff come in on like subcontracts to do study panels or groups. Mm-hmm. We have had going in recent years 1 or 2 or 3 study panels, and that's been our other way to do public business that gets beyond the academy out into the world and has some effect. One of the ones that has been most influential has been going for 4 years now and will probably continue. It's hard to tell what will continue with the current turbulence in Congress, mm-hmm. but it'll probably continue on into the future, and that's a study group to study a test that the public doesn't know about much, but education people know it as the National Assessment of Educational Progress. It's a huge congressionally mandated testing program, and sorry, I don't want to go into the details of that, but we have a very good, very expert panel that is monitoring the uses of that test, the structure of that test, and its relationship to other policies and so forth. We've just mounted an effort, foundation-funded, to look at the Clinton Goals 2000 process, but that's about to get sunk. So we'll probably shift our emphasis on that very good panel to the process that won't stop because it's going in 50 states, which is to have more school reform that's based on new and better assessments and more frequent assessments and based on new curriculum ideas, often called content standards. So there are a lot of national efforts to develop content standards, and the current environment in Washington is suspicious and hostile toward them, but the Academy will do something about them because in a lot of states the process is very far along, in Kentucky and Vermont and California and so forth. So we think it's interesting to try and figure out in a period of 3 or 4 years, if we can get a grant from these 3 foundations that have asked us to do it. They ask you to apply, and then they reserve the right to say no. But we're hoping to get a major grant from Carnegie and Pew Trust and MacArthur in Chicago to study this process in the States and try and get, probably not to the student learning level, that would be too much to hope for in 3 years, I think. But in this period of innovation, to get to levels that do affect classrooms, how many teachers report that there's made some impact on their teaching, and effects like that. We have some people on the panel that are very good at that kind of research. So we hope to have a voice in this educational reform area. We have another panel that's currently seeking funds that's called the Committee on, it's got a terrible name, I don't know if it augurs well for the committee or not, the Committee on the Conditions for Improving Educational Research, or some awful thing like that. You can't remember. I suggested an acronym that was catchy and spelled out, you know, RASCAL or something. they didn't buy it. So it's a committee with a boring name and no acronym. And it's supposed to try and figure out points at which educational research has not only been good, but has affected practice, and what were the conditions that fostered that, and kind of what is the infrastructure of creating new researchers in education.
So you have pretty much your own, you can just kind of go in any direction you want?
Well, sometimes people come to us and ask us. In the Clinton administration, there was in the House of Representatives a lawyer, I'm going to forget his name just for the moment now, who is the counsel, Jack Jennings, who is the counsel to the House Education Committee. And he started inserting in legislation in Goals 2000 that either the National Academy of Sciences or the National Academy of Education will study X. And then we would have to decide whether we were going to do it. There was a Bob Dole amendment to study the impact of Goals 2000 on children with disabilities. And that one, we decided we weren't the right people to do it. We invited the National Academy of Sciences to do it and said, fine. So we're trying to find ways to collaborate with the big academy, which has an interest in education, but there's some things we actually can do better and some things they can do better, and we try and keep everything above board and kind of communication going between us.
You talk about the new climate in Washington. For people listening, the Republicans have just been elected to a majority in the House and the Senate for the first time since the Eisenhower years.
That's right. The first person that uses this tape could be years from now. Right?
It could be years from now. Yeah, who knows?
Right.
100 years, Carl and I.
Yeah, this is December in the context of a November wipeout of the Clinton administration and Democrats in both houses and in many state houses.
Is this National Academy of Education is it a political organization in any sense, or will you be able to sit down with Newt Gingrich, the new Speaker of the House, and find some common ground and some issues to discuss?
Well, I doubt it, because I doubt that our membership would want to be in a position of saying there's enough consensus in this organization to... The panels that we have don't claim to speak for the entire membership of the Academy, and that's the same thing with the National Academy of Sciences. There's an interesting, delicate, and somewhat deliberately ambiguous relationship between a sitting panel that's going to do a 2 or 3 year study and commission research and develop policy ideas of its own. And you hate to have them say, well, don't express any policy preferences. Mm-hmm. People in the government would say, "What? Why are we giving you any money? You know, like, why would you not do that?" So the one we've had on NAEP, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, has tried to say things like, here's what research shows us if you take option A, and here's what research shows us if you take option B, or here's what we think some of the likely outcomes are, here's what testing experts would predict would happen if you move from divulging scores at the national level to the state level. That's what first got us in it. Well, we said, well, we know something about the consequences of that, because we know states run education programs, and we know that a state exam with the results divulged will have much more potential for people trying to teach to a test. So then the issue came up about what about divulging scores on this national test at the district level. So we sometimes express opinions, and we've come out very heavily against divulging them at the local level, because we said there is enough research to show you that it will destroy this as a national indicator of educational progress if you do that. It'll contaminate the test. If you make it high stakes for individuals, it will become just like any other curriculum test. It will be like a school test. And I don't want to talk more about that, but that's the kind of thing we might take a position on, where we think there's consensus within the panel, probably consensus within the academy, because the research moves in that direction. That's different than taking a position for or against choice or something, where it's not a research issue. It's a social philosophy issue, I think. So we would be unlikely, not that Newt Gingrich would be interested in this, but at a committee level in the Congress, they appreciated the kind of stuff we were doing with the NAEP, and they were quite anxious to get the report at various times. And it can get political, just depending on who there is out there who doesn't believe your advice and doesn't want your advice.
Right.
But I wouldn't say we would be the kind of champions of a Clinton education program or a Newt Gingrich education program. Anyway, that's been a lot of fun, and in a way, that has fed my appetite for administration. I get along very well with the executive director of this thing. We do a lot of fast communication with my executective counsel, and there's a lot of fun things that went on. We took the whole mob to Sweden and raised money.
Is that just recently?
Yeah, this past year. That was a lot of effort.
What was that for?
Well, just the we have a foreign associates membership, and one of our most active is a guy in Sweden, a guy named Torsten Hussein. 10 years ago, he invited us to Sweden, and this past year, he invited us to Sweden. But it was a heck of a lot of work for me and the staff to arrange the program and negotiate a program. It was an international program, and to get some money to fly on airplanes and so forth. And it was a great deal of fun. So I have a busy time in administration, and I guess I'm spending maybe a quarter of my time probably doing this. So there's a certain sense in which, once again, a national scholarly organization is benefiting from the Vilas professorship.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Going back to the university committees, leaving the National Academy of Education, you were also, John Palmer mentioned this to me, on the University Academic Planning Council. Could you talk about the UAPC? Could you talk about that for a few minutes?
Yeah, I enjoyed that a lot. And it was meaningful in my life. It's not so well known among faculty I noticed that a recent commission on how to strengthen faculty governance and possibly realign what different committees do advised that committee should have more functions or maybe more responsibility. When I got on it, I was told, well, the formal functions are the following. I won't go through all of them, but a lot of what it does is approve name changes of programs, approve the creation of programs, anything that's going to become the school of X, the department of X, the program in X, even the center for X, all has to be approved by that committee. So you can't name something, a program in or a department in or a school in, without that committee advising the chancellor. It's actually kind of formal, and a lot of times it's not that controversial. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if somebody wants to use the word physics in their department, they have to get the permission of the physics department, that kind of turf thing. And sometimes it's a matter of whether it's something that should be appropriately done at this university at all. Like there was a program for construction administration, and there was a lot of debate about whether that belonged at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Mm-hmm. And that's a complex issue at a place where we do quite a few very practical, worldly-oriented things. But this committee also acts as a kind of a kitchen cabinet. Kitchen cabinet is not right because the chancellor doesn't pick the members. A kind of a semi-cabinet for the chancellor. They are traditionally shown the budget, some version of the budget, and has to be talked about major priorities there. They're kind of the default group that you give ad hoc problems to. When I was on it, the state system decided there was going to be something called centers of excellence, and everybody had to start ginning up proposals to be centers of excellence. And the only way you were going to get new money was to become a center of excellence, and nobody knew what it meant. And it was a terrible idea. The University Academic Planning Council got to sort those all out and propose which ones the chancellor should pick. But I was on it for the very last semester, I believe, of Shane, and then a year of Bernie Cohen being acting chancellor, and then the first semester of Shalala, because I had a two-year term. Again, I don't remember if I was elected or appointed, but it had a membership like the campus planning committee, which was varied. There were various deans and so forth on it, and then representatives of the different divisions. What I liked was that Shalala did use it. Now remember, she has the university committee, which is elected, sort of serves the Senate in a way, but is elected by the entire faculty, not by the Senate, and is the voice of the faculty, and clearly so. They may speak for the university, but they speak for the university faculty. University Academic Planning Council is another one of these shared governance ones, which is administrators and faculty members, so there are various deans on it. And the chancellor, at least, I think all three, used it as a sounding board for various major campus problems. And in Shalala's case, for the Madison plan. Mm-hmm. I'm sure she had a lot of people commenting on the Madison plan, but we were one of them. And so we had some late evening meetings go on way longer than we thought they were going to, because we were going through all these issues about can you have a hate speech law, a rule or not. And there was a lot of confusion, a lot of feeling, and we hadn't conducted all these consultations with Gordon Baldwin and the Fidman and so forth yet. So that was quite exciting. I mean, it was an exciting...
So were you sort of like an advisory group to the chancellor?
And some things had to go through us, like name changes, and that sounds boring. And other things the chancellor just by tradition or by choice brought to us for feedback. And so that was a kind of a funny committee when I was on it. It may have had other functions that I can't remember. A lot of the work of it was relatively routine, but it's a way you found out about your campus if you want to. Some scholars don't want to find out about, you know, what the Department of Occupational Therapy is like. I sort of did, because I like administration, and I like watching these three different personalities react to the university's problems.
Just out of curiosity, do you recall what the group did advise Shalala about on the regarding the hate speech?
Well, I don't want to heroize myself, but I remember myself putting my oar in at a point where she had talked to Gordon Baldwin, and the Michigan guy was getting in trouble already with ACLU, and said, that's impossible, that can't be. And I said, I know it's late, I know we want to close this meeting down, but I just can't see that that's the case. I don't see how we can have rules that forbid classroom instructors from saying things that are hateful to students within their classes, and forbid supervisors or co-workers from doing it to co-workers, but somehow would leave totally in the world of academic freedom students harassing other students on the basis of race. I said, that doesn't sound right to me. So big deal, like as if I knew something. And then at that point they got Fidman and his students involved in it, and they developed a theory that said that you could have such a thing if you made a very clear distinction about what kind of speech acts you were talking about. They had to be more than they had to be repetitive and they had to be abusive and all this kind of stuff. And so Shalala then went with that advice and attempted such a rule. And of course, in the long run, these things mostly get struck down and don't work.
Anybody listening to this who's interested in that, I did cover that with Ted Finman in great detail, so please do listen to his interview. You also were on the search committee for provost, and this is the one that selected David Ward. Tell me a little bit about that process.
Yeah, well, the first thing is how I got on it. As I said in yesterday's tape, I knew Shalala a little bit before she came here, and although I said I've been on all these in these various venues where she saw me, like University Academic Planning Council. There are many faculty members that she used more and were more important. All kinds of people that had to do with important things that I had nothing to do with, athletic board and all this kind of stuff, and the university committee, which I've never been on. But there were times when she thought I would do a good job with something, and so when I was made a violas professor, I said, you know, Donna, don't do this. I know that violas professors are sometimes looked upon as outstanding, not just for research, but because they've had kind of a balanced citizenship in the university. And I said, my scholarship is certainly not greater than dozens of people around this place, but I will accept the notion. I didn't say all this to her, but it was my personal concept was that some violas professors have become violas professors because they were really good citizens and they were good scholars besides. So that's the greatest claim I could make for myself. So when they said she was offering me the violas professorship, I said, don't do this on the basis that I've been close to the university administration and all this stuff, because I really want to back off of that. I haven't done my scholarship properly, and I need to retreat, and I need, if I'm going to be a violas professor, to use it for its original purposes, which is to become a scholar and use that extra time for scholarship. And she said, oh, of course, absolutely. How about 5 years? We won't touch you for 5 years. No major committees for 5 years. And I said, that's
sure, she
that's
said
5 years
and not 5 minutes. So.
And so I, you know, that was fine. And I find it hard to do this stuff too. I find it hard to say no. But it was at a meeting of the National Academy of Education in Chicago where she was at, and I offered her a ride home. It was a time when she heard about the fraternity blow-up, about the racial epithets and so forth. So we got about halfway home from Chicago, and there we were. You know, it was really fun because you don't usually get a chance to talk to the chancellor for 2.5 hours. Mm-hmm. So we talked about all kinds of stuff, you know, growing up and graduate school and all these things. And then she talked me into being the chair of the committee to search for the senior executive vice chancellor of the university, which wasn't then yet called provost, but there was a mm-hmm. plan to call it provost. And I said, Donna, you promise. She said, oh, the staff on this is terrific. You know, it's Sue Finman. You won't have to do it. Just run the meeting and all this stuff, which is the way she got people to do things. And it was true. Sue Finman was involved in the staff, although she wasn't the day-to-day staff. There was a person that worked for Sue.
Secretary of the faculty, yeah. Sue was at the time. Yeah.
Well, it was a minor industry doing that. I found out what a major executive search is all about. I mean, they were people I had to consult, because the way we do them around here, we won't do them with headhunters. We don't do headhunters.
Good.
So Joe Kaufman told me about major searches. I mean, he's a person
Kaufman
who does consult
done.
On these
right.
things. And he told me all about the ethics of this and the stage at which you ought to do that and all this stuff. And it's a darn good thing I was a violas professor, because I couldn't have carried a full teaching load while I was doing that for 6 or 7 months. It was
really?
My main activity. And it was great fun, and we had a very good crop of people, and the end result was we didn't choose David Ward. I think we say that for shorthand, but we chose a slate of four people mm-hmm. from which Donna Shalala chose when the regents, then approved David Ward as vice chancellor. So that was a pleasure to me, because I had known him and, admired him on the graduate school research committee, but it wasn't as if I had more than one voice on the thing. So that was fun. And after that, both Shalala did make good. You know, she kidded me at her house one time. You get on all these committees, you get to pal around with these people and rub elbows with them. And I said, you remember that promise you made me? You didn't keep that promise. And it reminded me in one way of a funny story that Doc Howe, the former Commissioner of Education, made. And he said, I became Commissioner of Education, Lyndon Johnson appointed me. And I said, Mr. President, I don't want to do this if you're going to hand me any political appointments in the Department of Education. You know, you got to tell me which ones you're going to do right now, and then leave me alone, because I want to get my own professionals in there and so forth. All people say that. Johnson said, I promise, no political appointments. next week he was on the phone. You got to appoint so-and-so assistant secretary for elementary schooling, something like that. And Doc Howe said, Mr. President, you promised me. And Johnson said, yeah, I won't ever do it again. and he didn't, actually. No, usually people say that, and then they do. Well, Shalala did the same thing. She said, yeah, you're right. I didn't keep my word on that. I will from now on. And I haven't been on a major university committee since, except the Honorary Degrees Committee, which I think is a piece of cake, and it's fun, and
that's
I like
fun,
that activity,
yeah.
And it's not a strenuous committee. So I really did back off at that point. And I haven't been nearly as involved in the university governance since then, but I enjoyed the ride while I was doing it.
It's now December 1994, and you have recently, a while ago, this whole process with moving to Chicago has taken a bit. You will be leaving the University of Wisconsin. You said earlier, I think off tape, that you taught your last class today, and taking a position at the University of Chicago in the Department of Education. Another typo here. How did this come about, and why?
Well, since it's personal, I guess I have to be personal. I went through a divorce about 4 years ago, was the actual divorce, and I, after I recovered, began dating, and there's just no guarantee when you start dating that you're going to wind up making a commitment to someone who's a lifelong resident or an intended lifelong resident of Madison, Wisconsin, although I certainly socialized with some people who were. But in any case, the person I came to love and want to be with is a lifelong resident of Chicago. And so that was three and a half years ago. And her name is Elizabeth Hollander, and she's a city planner and a government reformer working on the now fashionable theory about reinventing government and total quality management and so forth. So she's known all over Chicago and depends for her work on those contacts and knowing the city well, knowing the people in the foundations well. It was not impossible to imagine her being in Madison, Wisconsin, and we in fact thought about it. We came up and I introduced her to people that are people of her sort. You know, I got a lunch together with Ann Arneson, who runs the Wisconsin Council on Human Concerns and had been chairman of the school board, and Becky Young, who's a state legislator, and Mary Lou Munns.
Now, Becky Young, you supported her. You ran her campaign for school board.
School board, that's right. That's right. I made that. Becky Young.
Go ahead.
And they were all supportive of Liz and the possibilities of, we'd see what we could do if you came on up here. We had some discussions about this, and Liz Hollander never made any kinds of demands or any kinds of general statements about how it would be easier for me to move than her. I figured that out. As much as I love this place and as much as I had no impetus to leave on professional grounds, I mean, I have the best job in my field in the country, and everybody knows that. Everybody in my field knows it. But it became abundantly obvious that as much as I like this place, a lot of what we do in academia travels with you, and that was true of almost nothing that had to do with Liz Hollander's job. She had no credentials. She has a BA in political science. It was all done on the job and through personal networks, and she's just woven into the politics of Chicago in a highly visible way that at our age, at 55, you couldn't possibly recreate. Even if Madison was a city of the size of Chicago, mm-hmm. She had thought when she was commissioner of planning in Chicago in the Harold Washington regime, after Harold died and the interim government of the mayor named Sawyer was about to end, and clearly the people who had been zealots for Harold Washington's cause were not going to survive into the next administration, the Young Daley administration. or maybe there was Jane Byrne and before, no, I've forgotten who came when. But at any rate, she had thought about what it would be like to, say, be commissioner of planning in Los Angeles or Boston or medium-sized city. And she thought, you know, it would take you 5 years to get up to speed to be able to have the networks to make the thing work. So I decided, and I actually at the end didn't consult with her, which she thought was odd, but I just thought it would be, it just seemed to me not to be ethically appropriate to be having a decision at the final stages with her about, I think I ought to come to you, not the other way around. So I made that decision. I'm confident that she wanted me to, that we wanted to be together. I visited at Chicago for a semester, and it worked out really well, both on the personal front, and I enjoyed the people at the Chicago Department of Education. So the question was, when I got done with that, would I say, yes, please make me an offer? And that opportunity to say yes came quicker than I thought it was going to. I thought it was going to happen in June, and in April the chair said, let's go out for breakfast, and popped the question to me because a dean had said, if you're going to do this case whole thing, get going on it. So at that point, that's what I mean when I say I didn't consult Liz. We talked about this a lot, but when he said, shall I go ahead with it, I said, yeah. And then it took a year and a half for them to get this all the way through the bureaucracy and the various levels at Chicago, which frustrated me, and it made for a very, very long exit here. I mean, a lot of my friends were very, very supportive, and yet at the same time they were kind of thinking, are you still here? Are you really going? Or maybe you're not going? And so forth. So Wisconsin has been peachy for me right up to the end, including the whole time I was here when I had declared that I had decided to leave. I was not interested in a counteroffer. It wasn't a matter that had anything to do with my job. Happily, everybody believed me about that. Nobody tried to get busy and, you know, feather my nest here and so forth. So it worked out the way I intended. I have a lot of regrets about leaving. Everyone knows that. I tried to express them more fully in a farewell party the other day that you were at. But the relevance of this thing for this tape is that sometimes things happen in academia that are purely for personal reasons. And I was glad when the State Journal ran a little piece on me, although I was very surprised, for precisely the reason that I think it's a big university with a lot of outstanding faculty. When a departure gets in the paper, it's usually on the subject the papers like to focus on, which is the competition for professors, the game of professoring. You know, is this university kind of standing up as well to the other places? Do the other places pay more? None of that had anything to do with my departure. So I don't know why the State Journal decided to run a little piece on it, but...
I think you just explained why.
in any case... I wanted to make the point that this is a great place. I love this place, and I'm going to be with a new partner. And I think the job at Chicago will be fine, but it won't be the job that I had here. And they're close enough so that we're all swearing that I'm going to have lots and lots of contact here, and I wonder whether that was going to be true, but so far I've got two orals scheduled for January and February. So,
are you going to, in terms of your research interests, are you going to... do you have any new plans for your Chicago years, or are you going to pretty much continue what you've been working
well,
on?
Well, the logic of what I've got planned is so ambitious that I think I probably got myself booked up for the rest of my career, and it's a pleasant agenda. The project on the history of the reading public got this new middle piece, which is to co-edit the book with Jan Radway,
right.
And that's a big collaborative project, which
that
is a lot
exciting.
Of fun.
Yeah.
The editorial board is wonderful, and we'll be inviting authors to write articles for us, but interacting with our views about what the history of the book is about. When I get done with that, my plan was to write a solo volume on the same subject. I don't know if I'm still going to do that or not. It'll depend on how that project works out. But nonetheless, I hope to get a grant and pursue that research on that old subject, the history of the federal role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've
and
talked about
that. That has a lot of poignancy. I thought it was interesting just because nobody's worked on it. And to write the whole history of the federal role would be like an encyclopedia. You have to get some slant on it. And mine is... more to look at the rhetoric and the popular beliefs in why the federal government ought to intervene in education in a country where the tradition and even the Constitution has run against that. So what is it that makes us escalate into new beliefs that the federal government ought to be involved in education? What did the people think they were up to, and what was the public reception of that, and you know, and what were the results of that? So something like that would be my handle on this
That's
subject.
Well, yeah.
You know, this seemed pretty academic for a while until the Republican Revolution that took place last month, because now there's been a proposal, why don't we just abolish the Department of Education? Why should the federal government have anything to do with education whatsoever? So I'm thinking, gee, if I could toss them this book right now without doing the research, it might be relevant to the policy debate. In any case, I think the federal role in education in this country is both important enough and controversial enough so that there will be some room to write a book about it 4 years from now or whatever, and that's my intention, is to do that. Once again, maybe collaboratively, maybe with a research grant, but I think by the time I do the history of the book and the history of the federal role, I've got probably enough to keep me busy till I go to the county home.
Well, on that note, and I really do mean this, I wish you well, Carl, and thank you so much for enduring these last 4 hours over the last 2 days.
Thanks.